Welcome to the show. I am really excited about tonight's show. Unfortunately, Alejandro is on the road traveling, and he said, "Oh darn, he just can't. He's not going to be anywhere that where he can actually talk with us." So he is not going to be on the show. But I have a show with what I consider two really wonderful, nice guys tonight. Sam Maranto is joining us from Chicago in the beginning of the show. And then after that, we have Preston Dennett, and he has written a book about schoolyard UFOs, and we're going to be talking all about that. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show, and that means people behind the scenes and also the people that help support the show. And anybody can do that. All you have to do is go over to podcastufo.com. All that information's over there. We're also on Patreon as well. And I was just this last Sunday, what was that, 2 days ago, I was on the PowerCast and had a really good conversation with Randall and Gene over there. And you can check that out over at the PowerCast. And level-headed, great conversations. And also, I mean, it was a real pleasure. And I've been thinking, you know, maybe I'll get both of them at different times on this show. It'd be a lot of fun. I was really impressed at how knowledgeable both of them are. Randall, who I'd never talked to before, really knew his stuff, and it was a lot of fun. And if anyone would like to get a shout out if you support the show, I'd be happy to do that. And I think I'm trying to read this. I was sent a long email. I simply asked David and Heather if I could do a shout out in Phoenix for them. And he just wrote me a long email back, and I'm hoping somewhere in that email he says, "Yeah, go ahead." And I hope it doesn't say don't do a shout out. But anyway, so anyone that supports a show, I'd be glad to do a shout out for you. Just email me and tell me if you want me to use your full name or just first name. And that's Martin at podcastufo.com. And I am getting my good buddy here from Chicago on right now, Sam Maranto. Welcome to the show.
Boy, it's good to be back and great to hear your voice. It was also magnificent to hear that wonderful Race Hobbs. Oh, my gosh. What a wonderful voice.
I know. What a radio voice, huh?
One of a kind.
Hey, what do you think of my hat?
I love it, actually. Yeah.
All the time I say, well, I'm not necessarily saying it's aliens. Well, my hat says it's aliens. Anyway, Sam, this is not a typical news segment. I just wanted to have you on because there's always something going on out in the Chicago way. And when I found out Alejandro couldn't be on, I thought, hey, well, let's see if Sam can be on. Sam, first of all, I know this is the near anniversary of a couple of major sightings. Let's see, was it November 7th? O'Hare, is that when that was?
You got it. 4:20 or so in the afternoon, gate C-17, object sitting below ceiling of approximately 1,900 feet, and it's about 450 feet below that. This object is sitting there looking much like, you know, to some degree we keep hearing about this tic-tac, but if you look at a disc object from a side angle, it's just a matter of where you're looking at it, your vantage point. This object sat there for a good 20-plus minutes. I had the privilege of speaking to three people who saw it, a couple of other individuals who were talking to people on the radio who weren't able to see it themselves but were able to communicate with them as they were watching it. And there is absolutely no doubt that this object that bolted through the sky that day was not a lenticular cloud that went through that some 6,000 feet of ceiling of cloud layer that sat there and bolted through in an instance to the point that people were gasping and reacting with shock. So when you hear these crazy stories that so-called skeptics come up with, you could just remind them to take a peek at the NARCAP Scientific Technical Report number 10 and that's at narcap.org. Read the details on that, and if that isn't enough information, I believe it's darn near 200-some pages of very good scientific evaluation. And, oh, yes, my interviews are in there, so I definitely was part of the case itself. Somebody said I wasn't. I don't know how that happened, but I most certainly was. And now, yes, that was on the November the 7th, 2006.
Now, you just mentioned it wasn't a cloud, and I'm going to ask you, are you addressing, I don't know if you listened to when I had Seth Shostak on, I don't know, what was it, 3 weeks ago? But he's the one who, he actually said it was a cloud. Is that kind of why you're addressing that in particular?
Yes, in particular, I'm addressing that. Plus, there was an astronomer from the Adler who came on. It was an interview that I was supposed to attend. I didn't have time to get down there and do it. It was one of these last-minute phone calls. They wanted me in studio to do an interview. But that notion was brought up, stating that, oh, we know what it was, a lenticular cloud. First of all, lenticular clouds are rarely seen in the Midwest. You have to have a pretty good wind to create that. And you'll find them on the leeward side of a mountain.
Right.
Or, for instance, something very tall. You do get them in the Midwest, but they're extremely rare. One of my witnesses, my main witness, was a person who did a lot of mountain climbing. And when she heard lenticular cloud, she said, well, that was just a bunch of caca, is how she referred to it. And there's no way possible that that was the case. And this object sat there. She was evaluating it as from the point of what kind of construction it was actually made of. She was a military brat. Her father was the captain of an air wing for the Navy, and she was raised in the environment of aviation, and she knew the proper terminology when she came to analyzing the object. She was also a reporter and a very smart person. She was a talking head for one of the television stations out there. So in Washington, this was somebody that knew what she was talking about. Plus, we had pilots. We had ground traffic personnel that were taxiing 737s back and forth to their hangars. They seen it. Bottom line, this object was there. I can't say it was something that was from out of this world, but it exhibited some extremely remarkable technology.
Wow. Another real mystery, as they say. And I know I've asked you this question. It just seems like it's a matter of time before, you know, a pilot will retire. You know, the retirement age for a commercial pilot is 65, so they have to retire at 65. And it just seems like some should have retired by now that would want to talk about actually seeing this object.
I'm hoping that is the case. One individual I did speak to was at a retirement, was a senior group. And this gentleman was a manager handling security underground built between gate seat 17, the gates C concourse and B concourse, and was managing the oversight of inspecting the luggage for security. And he heard the chatter back and forth, and he called his friend in the B concourse, was a manager, and he was giving him a complete, a very well detailed observation of what he was seeing. And he said, by no accounts was that even remotely anything resembling a cloud. It was an object, cut and dry. It was an object.
Well, I've been texting, so I'm going to have to actually say this, and I apologize for having to say this, but some people are saying that there's no audio over on KGRA radio currently. So, Race, if you can hear me, you may want to check that out. They do have, obviously, they do have audio on YouTube, because people are commenting about what we're talking about. So You and I were talking a little bit earlier, just chatting, and you said that Mothman, I know this isn't UFOs, but Mothman just won't go away. What's going on with that?
Oh, that fireman, I tell you what, we had another report that came in. You know, the whole series of Mothman reports that came into MUFON, which were about 10 of them. Two of them, one was a call-in, one was an email that came in through the Illinois MUFON website, not from the MUFON CMS. You know, most of these, if not all of them, except for two, I should say, all except for two, had no contact information. Everything was just voided or fictitious. And the details, there was a lot of information there. It was just absolutely incorrect. People being outside during the rain, stating that they were seeing the reflection of the moon and the eye of the creature while they're out on Lake Michigan in 3 to 7 foot waves. At 10 o'clock at night, the moon wasn't up till 11:43. I mean, we understand all the things that cannot be altered and are just scientifically definitely solid as far as verifiable evidence, and yet they come up with all this nonsense. It seemed like all of them had some very good creative writing in play and some highly convincing narratives. And this is the same thing that's been going on. But now what's going on is they're trying to turn it, and all of a sudden the investigators are the bad guys because we're asking questions. We'd like to have the people go out to the location, point out exactly where something is, so we could do the usual scientific stuff like figure out how high something is in the air, see if we could triangulate it, get some idea on the size of the actual object. Nothing like this can go on unless you have some help. And this is a nonsense, but it's starting up again. Wouldn't it be nice to have some cryptid thing floating around that we could actually nail down and say, here, we could add this to the books of some new cryptid thing, you know, being whatever it is, if it's extraterrestrial, interdimensional, or just one more freaky thing that we've missed somehow, and it's been living in the bushes. Who knows? But all the new reports are coming around from the area around the O'Hare Field, which is not a good place to go flying around if you're 7 foot tall.
Wow. I didn't have any idea that it was ever around the airport. Is this something new?
Yes. This is a new area that we're starting to get the reports from. And again, some of the information just doesn't add up, the timelines. But then again, all these reports, the minute you start asking to have a phone interview or any other form of contact, they insist that you're meddling, that you're being too pushy, that they wish to stay anonymous. If you call in or if you send a report in anonymous, you're already there. I can't grant anonymity to something that isn't known. It's like that's an impossible act. So the bottom line is, if you're going to fill out a report, expect to get some sort of communication from us to at least get more detail to help you figure out what it is. And that's all we're interested in doing.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, Sam, I can't believe how much the time has just flown by. It seems like we just started chatting here. Anyway, thanks so much. I appreciate you filling in for our good friend, Alejandro. And you take care out in Chicago, and my best to Julie, and we'll talk soon.
Yes, take care. I'll see you.
All right. All right, everyone. So our guest coming up now is Preston Dennett. And Preston has been on, I think, at least two times ahead. Real fun guy, nice guy. Always enjoy speaking with him. And he has been investigating UFOs and the paranormal all the way back since 1986. He's written several books, I think 24 books and over 100 articles on UFO and paranormal. And again, I just always enjoy speaking with him. And welcome to the show, Preston.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right. There you are. I'm seeing you. I'm seeing you, but I'm not seeing you on the... I don't know what's going on with Skype tonight, but
not behaving?
It's not behaving. Let me just see if I can change... There you are. Okay. All right, I'm going to do some adjustments on this end. All right, here you go. We're going to put you on. Here you go. Preston, for the person who has never heard you on the show, why don't you give a quick background and what got you interested in the topic, all that good stuff.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was originally born in Illinois, moved here to California with my family. I've got five brothers and sisters, and I thought we were all skeptical of UFOs. It turns out, no, some of them had seen UFOs and didn't tell me. I was very skeptical. It wasn't until 1986, November 17th, I think it was exactly, there was a sighting over Alaska. Captain Kenju Tiroshi, it's a very famous case.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this pilot is obviously lying, or he's on drugs. I mean, what is going on? Because the news just kind of laughed about it. They were very tongue-in-cheek and moved on. But I remembered my brother had said he'd seen a UFO, and I didn't believe him. And I asked him about it and got a real shock. You know, he had two friends with him. He chased this metallic disc for several miles in his car. And I started asking people and found out that, you know, not only, you know, some of the people within my family, but my friends and my coworkers as well, not only had sightings, but missing time and, you know, face-to-face encounters with gray ETs. So, yeah, it hit home for me. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it wasn't good news. I was pretty upset about it, really.
Really? That's, you know, sometimes I hear kind of that reaction, but sometimes mostly about someone that has their own sighting, but not generally when they're listening to other people's accounts. Are you saying this reaction of yours has to do more of like it was something that you didn't know about, sort of like a secret out there, and all of a sudden you know about it? Why was your reaction the way it was, I guess, what I'm looking for?
I guess I had a lot of anger because this wasn't taught in schools. And the people I thought, you know, who loved me were lying, essentially. And I get it. You know, that I was vehemently skeptical. I was taking all kinds of science classes in college. And I was, you know, dug in terms of, you know, UFOs not being real. So it was a big adjustment for sure. And finding out that our own government is using our own tax dollars to basically ridicule witnesses and cover up events and, you know, cover up the truth really upset me. So there, yeah, it was a not good news. I mean, it was very interesting. I became obsessed very quickly, bought all the books I could, magazines. I subscribed to MUFON, became a member or a field investigator. I was tromping through the fields. I was going to see if these things were real.
Wow. And what was your investigation like when you worked for MUFON? Did you have any really interesting cases that you personally investigated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I worked directly with MUFON for a number of years early on and just kind of fed some cases to them, and mostly sightings and things like that. Don't work so much with MUFON these days. I'm still a field investigator and a member. I support them. I think there's a lot of really good people in MUFON. But like every UFO, citizen UFO organization in the U.S., there's problems with them. Hmm. I mean, this is what we saw with APRO, who was essentially spied on by the CIA. The Lorenzans caught them doing it. And what's the other one? Not APRO, not QFOS. NICAP, that of course fell apart due to infiltration. So, you know, and MUFON, I love them, but their membership is what, a few thousand? Why isn't it 100,000? I don't understand
that's
this.
That's always puzzled me too. And it's not likely it's an expensive membership. I've had a little few discussions with Jan Harzan about, you know, how he tries to get, you know, members involved. And now I see they have a new, like, MUFON TV show. I watched part of it the other day. You know, maybe they're trying to get experimental and trying to figure out ways to, you know, get more members involved. But yeah, it's a, it is surprisingly a low membership. And yeah, I know the controversy, and there's some people that have just plain left because of it. And I think, you know, whenever something like you mentioned, whenever something like this can easily get out of hand in different ways, you know, the politics of it and the whole thing. Yeah. And then when there's money involved, weird things can happen too. So yeah. I know they've had their struggles.
Well, I like Jan. I met him, you know, at the conference in Irvine when I spoke there. And I'm hopeful for this all continuing in a good path. Mm-hmm. But we have to remember that this is a real subject. UFOs are real. The evidence, I think, is conclusive, really, within the public arena, if you're willing to search it out. And there is a cover-up. It's demonstrable. So, and it hasn't stopped yet.
Right.
So there's push and pull forces here that are making this very difficult to move this subject forward.
Right, right. Let's see. I think we're going into break right now. So we're going to go into our first break. We're going to get into your book because I find that really fascinating, the schoolyard UFO encounters. But first of all, in your area, what part of California do you live in?
Southern California, outside L.A., in Reseda.
And what's the fires? How are you dealing with that out there?
Oh, boy, just a couple of weeks ago, it was pretty scary. I mean, I had fires on both sides of me. I personally was in no danger, but my family, my brother and sister-in-law were just about getting ready to evacuate.
Wow.
And have other people who are in direct path of the fires in Northern California. So it's been horrendous. Yeah, it's a big deal. I've lived here for a long time, since 1971, and wildfires are nothing new. But not like this. I have to tell you, they don't race across and just demolish 1,000 homes in minutes.
That's right. And I know we're doing a show about UFOs, but I do want to talk a little bit about this because I think it's actually, you know, scary and interesting at the same time. But I went out to California a few years ago visiting, and I went up to Yosemite, and I couldn't believe what I saw with the beetle kill. That happens when there's a drought, and the trees can't produce enough sap to protect themselves against the beetle. And so the beetles will kill these trees. But I mean, what a fire hazard Yosemite, which is such a beautiful area, what a fire hazard Yosemite itself is. And I'm surprised that doesn't torched. You know, it's just so much tin. What do they call it? Tinder, they're just waiting to light there. But I don't know if it's going to get any better in California. I mean, it's like there's not too. It seems like there's most of this. You know, the wooded areas have been hit one way or another in the last few years. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, there's still a lot of forest out there, thank God. And I think at some point this has got to stabilize. If we work on our environment, it's the number one message from the ETs, by the way, environmentalism.
That's one of the things I want to talk about because, you know, a lot of these schoolyard encounters, They do have messages. All right, everyone, welcome back. This is Martin Willis, and my guest is Preston Dennett, and we're going to be talking about schoolyard encounters, and that's where we're going to start. Preston, so what made you decide you were going to write this book about these encounters, which, by the way, is one of the most interesting aspects of this phenomena as far as I'm concerned?
I kind of slipped into it by chance. Coincidentally, one of my early cases, my first humanoid case, actually took place right in front of an elementary school. So I started running into these cases early on. And of course, when the Rua Zimbabwe case occurred, I'm like, wow, this is really unusual. I thought it was unusual. But I kept hearing more cases. I ran into another of my own down in Hawthorne at a Catholic school and thought, gosh, I wonder if this is a thing, because I'd been looking into various areas that I call UFO attractors, sort of like mines, you know, metal mines, iron mines, copper mines, attract UFOs. So do rocket launches, anything to do with rockets, nuclear stations. And I thought, I wonder if schools are a thing, because I had heard of course, the Westall Melbourne case at Westall High School, where some 200 kids saw a UFO land, 300. And I thought, gosh, you know, I think there's another. I remembered one up in Wales where they saw humanoids. I did not know about the Opa-locka Crestview case. So these are all the more famous cases. And so I decided to dig in a little bit, because I had read this case where a student had said that he had grays walk into his classroom during class. And time stopped. And these grays were just going up and down the aisles. No one was moving. And at this point, he couldn't move. He couldn't talk. And suddenly they were gone. Time speeded up again, and everyone acted like nothing had happened. And I thought, oh my God, you know, our school's being targeted by UFOs. So I did a sort of a survey of the literature, starting with the books in my library and magazines and UFO news clipping service. I checked out MUFON and NewFork and other UFO databases. And I have to tell you, you know, I got a real shock. Having investigated UFOs for, 30 years now, most of my life, I knew pretty much what was going on. And this really threw me for a loop, because I found over 100 cases.
Wow.
Pretty quickly.
That's amazing.
Right? All over the world, stretching back. Gosh, the earliest one I found was 1853. It's an outlier. That's in Tennessee. These UFOs hovered over a college. But really starting in 1950 and onward from that year, at least three high-quality cases per year, all the way up pretty much to the present day.
I think, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, the topic of schoolyard encounters came up, and I believe I said, I think there's at least 4 or 5 of them. I had no idea. If you had told me there was 100, at that time, I would have, I wouldn't say I wouldn't believe you, but I mean, it's just, I can't believe there's that many. That's just amazing. And, we know of, like you just mentioned, too, that, I'm very familiar with. And by the way, on December 10th, we have Ryan Shane is going to be on about the Westall encounter, December 10th. So, but the Ariel School, to me, is one of the major ones, just because of, there's so many reasons why, the 65 or whatever it was, school children. And so many of them, saw the beings. And speaking of beings, how many of these encounters, I don't know if you can try to make a stab at how many of them had actual being sightings in all those 100?
Yeah, 10% at least. Actually, what I found was, it surprised me, 30% of the cases involve landings and or humanoids. Oh. So what we're dealing with are not, first of all, it's not a coincidence. This is not like random flybys. Your average kind of sighting is about 4,000 feet up, an anomalous light at night, very brief, and it darts away, right? That's not what's happening here. These cases are fundamentally different in several really profound and significant ways, I think. First of all, being that these are very low-level sightings, I would say that 1,000 feet would be on the higher end for these objects. They come down to usually 200 feet, 150. Like I said, in some cases, landing. These objects are directly targeting the schools. They're appearing from, say, the horizon or way up in the sky and come right over the school, perhaps circling around it, but usually stopping right over it or landing next to it, usually behind the school in a grove of trees when they do land. What's also unusual about these cases is they occur during daytime, which, most sightings are at night. So this is a significant difference and also removes the possibility of misperception. Another thing is they last a long time. You know, 10 minutes would be sort of the shorter end. 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours. A couple of these cases occur over a period of days or even a week.
Wow.
Of repeated visits. Yeah. Not at all unusual. Also unusual is the fact that we're not dealing with, you know, your average amount of 4 to 7 witnesses. We are dealing with an average of 30 witnesses per case. You know, in many cases, there's 40, 50, 100, 200, 400 witnesses.
Wow.
And not just students, by the way. Teachers in about half the cases. There's often a governmental response. There's, you know, military or state government, police. There's also a wave of publicity usually that follows these sightings that they generally do make the local newspapers, sometimes international. But yeah, something crazy is definitely going on with these types of cases. And one more quick thing is half of the cases are elementary schools.
Yeah, we talked just for a couple minutes before the show, and I was saying to you that I think one of the reasons these sightings are happening is because kids are very impressionable. And when you're going back to elementary schools, you know, that even makes the case even a little stronger. And how many of these cases are you aware of where they're actually, the kids are actually outside, like on the playground or something like that? Is there a good percentage of that?
Yeah, 90.
Really?
Really, most of them, yeah. And what we do see is that these things show up during recess. It seems, you know, to be happening so consistently that I just can't imagine this is a coincidence. There are a number of cases where kids are in their classroom. And these objects hover right outside the school and cause, you know, classroom chaos, to say the least. But most of the cases, yeah, the kids are on the playground. It's usually, you know, early morning recess, lunchtime, or school has just been let out. Number of cases just like that.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think it's intentional. And these ETs are, because what we often, you know, I do believe we're dealing with ETs, just to put that out there, extraterrestrials in the classic sense. I think that they're casing the joint, if you know what I mean. They're scouting the area out prior to this, because often in these cases, there are sightings before the event and after. That was certainly true in the aerial case.
So are you saying before the actual event of the encounter, there's sightings after and before? Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, particularly in the case of the landings.
Mm-hmm.
What we see is in the cases where the UFOs are landing next to schools, the day before that, there'll often be sightings. And after that, for that matter.
Yeah.
Not always, but certainly it is a pattern.
So it is almost like they're scouting it out in a way. And yeah. And I want to go over some of the cases, but you mentioned sometime the military gets involved. Can you talk about any of the cases where that is the case?
Yeah, I think probably the one that comes to mind would be the Marysville, Ohio, the Jerome Elementary School. I have the date for that somewhere around here. 1954, October 22nd. Great case, really amazing. Began when a bunch of children, about 60 children, were on the playground and saw this sort of football-shaped object with very bright lights, perhaps portholes, but probably lights because it was very bright, came swooping down to about 200 feet and hovered there for a good 5 or 10 minutes before some kids decided, you know, maybe we better call the teachers. And called out the principal, Mr. Dimmick, and he was amazed. He's never seen anything like it. He says it was so bright he had to shield his eyes. He immediately called for another teacher. She ran out and didn't see it because this thing darts away at full speed. But sighting wasn't over yet. At this point, the sky fills with this sort of cotton candy-like substance, which we now know is angel hair.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively rare. I mean, there's quite a number of cases, but not a lot compared to the number of sightings that are out there. And this is just sort of this weird spider web type substance. And it was thick all over the playground. It targeted the school. It was, in my mind, clearly a display of some kind done intentionally. I don't think this is UFO exhaust or anything. I think they put this out there for the kids. I really do. And I can tell you why. But at any rate, they scooped it up. You know, they brought some to the teachers. The teachers fussed around with it. They sent a sample to the local newspaper, who sent a sample to Lockbourne Air Force Base, and they never heard back from them. But the Air Force did express interest in this case, particularly, and seemed to express interest in all the cases where there's perhaps photographs taken or moving films, or another case just like this 1 year later, Whitsitt Elementary School, another Angel Hair Fall case, where the Air Force showed up to interview people and tried to debunk the case. But turns out the principal who saw this, this is also Whitsitt Elementary School, he witnessed the whole thing. Turns out he was a World War II vet who had flown like 30-some combat missions and new aircraft and was just not having what this Air Force major was trying to do, which was debunk the case.
Mm. Oh, wow. So you talked about the angel hair. I know there was a case, I can't remember anything about it, other than that it was found, they found a bunch of it in the trees. I know it was a woman witness. And has any of that ever been tested, actually? You mentioned that the Air Force never got back to anyone. But have people tested otherwise?
Oh, yeah, certainly in other cases. And in the Whitsitt Elementary School case, they did send a sample off to Burlington Scientific Labs, who returned it saying they were not able to identify it as other than possibly an organic substance, and they thought it might be spider webs. Mm. And recommended, which it couldn't be because there was this was thick on the playground. Wow. At any rate, they did send it to a biologist, and the biologist said flat out, no, this is not spider webs. You know, there's no evidence of spiders here. The strands are way too even. And it does. Chemical analysis has shown, you know, I forget what the actual elements are in there, but I remember boron is one of them, which isn't a super common element, but is something we use for nuclear shielding of reactors, I believe. So that kind of piqued my interest. I'm like, I wonder if there's something to that. But generally, the substance dissolves very quickly. It's extremely hard to gather samples of. So there hasn't been a whole lot of study of it, but there has been some.
Wow. Now, are there any other, as far as you know, are there any other trace evidence cases when it comes to schoolyard sightings?
Oh, yeah. There was a case in South Africa at Richmond High School, where a UFO landed on the high school tennis courts overnight. Guy who, again, it was principal, by coincidence, actually lived next to the school, saw these lights outside his window. There was some security guards who saw it, and I believe another police officer saw it. So a number of witnesses saw these strange lights, and the next morning they go to these tennis courts where these lights were, and they were tore up, and they couldn't figure out how it was done because they were locked up in secure fencing. The gates weren't disturbed, the fences weren't damaged, but the blue gum tree next to the tennis courts was all burnt. The floor of the tennis courts was tore up all over the place, and they found some of the tar several hundred yards away on a mountainside, a little hillside. So that was curious. They have no idea what exactly happened in that case, but that's one of a number of landing trace cases. I know the Westall case had some pretty significant landing traces. There's a number of cases with physiological reactions as well. So yeah, and there was, let's see, the Moline, Illinois case, Sacred Heart Elementary School. 40 children and 3 nuns saw this UFO hovering over it. There was a police officer who had a movie camera and was able to take footage of it. I saw the footage. It's not great by today's standards, but it's really, in my mind, great evidence because we have so many witnesses supporting this. We know it's not a hoax, and certainly the Air Force showed a lot of interest in it, and the guy who took the footage, the police officer, was actually visited by so-called men in black who refused to identify themselves, right? Perhaps the government type as opposed to the sort of weirder alien type. Government officials from some unnamed agency who expressed a lot of interest in his film and wanted to see it.
I was just looking over the list, and there is, I mean, I've never heard of any of these. So you mentioned in your research that you went into, say, your books and then your articles, and then and you mentioned something about newspaper clips. I mean, it must be so hard to find these. I mean, or can someone actually find a lot of these through the internet?
I cast a pretty wide net. You know, I've got pretty big library. I subscribe to the UFO News Clipping Service before, you know, there was internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I found some really wonderful databases. I have to tell you, MUFON and NUFORC, National UFO Reporting Center, had a lot of information. APRO, QFOS, NICAP, lots of the magazines. So, yeah, I did cast a wide net. I traced some of the cases myself, you know, and was able to talk to witnesses firsthand. So, yeah, it was definitely a real research project, for sure. But boy, when I found one of these cases, I'm like, wow, here's this pattern again exerting itself, where all this UFO shows up at recess. And these are displays. Clearly, these UFOs are showing themselves off on purpose. It's a sort of UFO behavior that's not super common, but turns up regularly. And that's what they're doing in these cases, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, we'll get into the different cases, the unknown cases that I'm interested in. But let's talk about, earlier you said something along the lines of, you know, the environment, the message. Are there a lot of cases where people actually, you know, children are mentioning, you know, that they either had a vision or they felt like they were communicated with? And if so, you know, what kind of percentage of that is what we've heard in the past about environmental, you know, related?
Right. Now, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of direct communication cases. Mm-hmm. There's a smattering of them. The Rua Zimbabwe case is really the ultimate case of this kind,
mm-hmm.
which has all the elements, including, you know, landing, humanoids, multiple witnesses. No teachers saw that one, though.
Well, one has come. When I was speaking to James Fox out in Phoenix, he told me that there was one teacher that admitted to him that she actually saw it, and she kept quiet about it. So,
wow.
So he did get an interview with her. It's going to be in his film when it comes out, whenever that is. Hopefully it'll be soon. But yeah, that'll be interesting to hear her side of it.
Yeah, but most of them, no, don't have messages. It's certainly the most common message I hear when someone's taken on board a craft, regardless of the date of their encounter or the type of ET they're interacting with. That's the number one message people are given. And it was there in the Rua Zimbabwe case. And there's only, gosh, a couple of other cases where people got any message at all. So that is actually really rare.
Oh, yeah. I was hoping there would be more of those, because I just find it really, really an added, you know, amazing element to the whole situation. And you mentioned a couple of times there's principles. How often would you say are faculty involved in actually, you know, seeing these things? Is it rare, or is it, you know, half and half, or what is it?
It's about half. You know, it's hard to say for sure because a lot of these cases aren't really thoroughly investigated. But and I'm just astonished at how many cases there are where there's elementary age witnesses who see this stuff and there are no teachers who are admitting it, at least.
Mm.
So what were, like the Rua Zimbabwe case, well, I found out there's a teacher there just now. I think that we're seeing, that's probably more likely the case, that a lot of these teachers are just not going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas students, you know, children are unencumbered by society and preconceptions, which I think actually makes them great witnesses in a lot of ways.
Right.
They're often marginalized, unfortunately, in terms of being UFO witnesses, or really witnesses in any event. There's that old adage, children should be seen and not heard. And that was truer back then, you know, than it is now. But my phone's ringing. Sorry about that. But yeah, I think that this is actually a lot more common, and teachers see them probably in at least half the cases, probably more. But there's a bunch of cases there where it's just the kids.
One of the things I thought was really made the case a little extra credible about the Ariel school is when I spoke to Salma Siddiq, she said that the term UFO or anything like that had never, she'd never known about. You know, they're kind of remote. And so that wasn't something that she would have ever conceived or thought of on her own, you know, when she was actually seeing this. I think I heard either Emily or her, the two witnesses I've spoken to, one of them said they thought it must be something like military or something like that. She was just, they were just trying to figure things out. And are there any other cases that you're aware of where it was sort of in a remote area, or most of these, like, you know, in the suburbs or urban areas?
Gosh, no, I have never been asked that before. I think they're mostly suburban. I'm trying to think of any really remote areas. I mean, this occurs all over the world.
Yeah.
So we're seeing cases in England, Canada, France, all across South America, Africa, Australia, across Europe. So most of them are, you know, in town, I guess you would say, not rural areas. And it's puzzling because cases like the Opa-locka, Florida case, Crestview Elementary School in 1966, had a number of these objects hovering over the school. One landed, some 200 kids saw this, as well as the teachers. There's an airport like 2 miles away who claims to have seen nothing. That's true with the Westall case in Melbourne, Australia. That's true with a case in New Zealand in 1970 where there were 400 students on the playground, two teachers. It's a great case. The teachers were suddenly realized something was up when the students weren't playing. All the sounds of their playing had stopped. And they look up, and there's this giant thing approaching their playground. It's huge. It gets bigger and bigger. It's this sort of black disc and glistening and glinting in the sun there, and gets right over the school, and covering a third of the sky, they said. Very large, hovered for about 10 minutes, and eventually moved off a little bit and then took off straight up. There's an airport right next door. They called him up, of course, and nothing. You know?
Wow.
So, yeah, I think what we're looking at here is a situation where they're showing off themselves to a select group. And you could be at the airport and you're not going to see this, unless they're all lying, which is entirely possible. But I don't know, because I keep seeing this in case after case where it's just the school who's seeing this.
I'm trying to remember which case it is. It might be Westall. I believe that's the case where the film was actually confiscated from a teacher. Is that a common theme? We're going into a break here in just a minute, but is that a common thing as far as you know?
No, it's not super common. And yes, that is the Westall case, which was another one of the ultimate cases. There's six really big cases, and that's one of them, where there was an active sort of attempt to cover up events, which was pretty successful for a long time. Thanks to the work of, you know, Shane Ryan.
Yeah.
It's come out now, and there's a, so, but yeah, that... That doesn't happen a lot because people don't really haven't taken a lot of pictures. And those that have were well received and published in newspapers and so on.
I believe, I don't know, a half hour ago, I mentioned that Shane Ryan was coming on December 10th, and I believe I called him Ryan Shane. I may have, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, he's a nice guy. He did a lot of really good work on that. So we're going to go into the break now. So everyone, this is our real break. We're going to go into that, and we'll be back right after these messages. Well, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. And please, if you're interested in signing up, go over to podcastufo.com, and you'll see the support the show page There's actually on the menu bar you can get there. I would suggest Patreon because you can get the link right there for your media player feed. It's not as complicated, I think. I'm not really sure. I mean, I have a subscription service set up there. But if you want to do a yearly payment as low as $15 a year, you can do that on our support page right there. Next week, we have astrophysicist Jeffrey Bennett on. He's going to talk about UFOs and more. And we have Deep Prasad, who is I believe he's a quantum physicist. So we have a real sciencey show. So don't miss that. I have been doing, when I have multiple guests, I've been doing a full bonus show. I'm going to see how that goes. I might do that again next week. But we really all do appreciate your support. You can listen to the full show, of course, live on Podcast UFO or on YouTube. That's every Tuesday night at 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Or you can actually watch the full show on YouTube if you want to. But if you support the show, we'll give you a link for your media player so you can listen to a podcast while you're driving, any of that great stuff. So, all right, everyone, thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.